Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you all for coming. Welcome to the Tattered Cover in Lower Downtown. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. We really appreciate your support of our author programs, and we also appreciate your support of independent bookstores. Tonight, it's a great pleasure to introduce New York Times best-selling, award-winning mystery author, Nevada Barr, who will talk about her newest in the National Park Ranger Anna Pigeon series called The Rope. In a recent Denver Post article, which I hope you all saw, by William Porter, Nevada Barr's life was highlighted, and it started from when how she became an actress and then actually became a park ranger and how she got to writing. And we're so glad she started the Anna Pigeon novels, because I know it's one of my favorite series, and obviously it's yours as well. So in The Rope, this is one you can read and enjoy, and it's sort of about how Anna became who she is today. And I will say, you might want to leave the lights on. There are some scary bits, but you'll enjoy it. It takes place in Glen Canyon Recreational Area, and I'm just so happy that Nevada Barr is here. Please welcome Nevada Barr.
I thought today I would talk about how I came to write at all and how I came to the Anna Pigeon series, and then, of course, about the newest book that's just come out, and then take some questions. Does that sound okay? Okay. First of all, how many writers do we have here? Okay, we've got quite a few. How many published writers do we have? Okay, published writers, this isn't for you. This is for the non-published writers. I started the Anna Pigeon series. It got published in 1993, and I got a whole bunch of first best novel awards for it. And I want you non-published writers to know this was my fifth book. I had written one that was published in 1983. It was called Bittersweet. And at the time that I wrote this, I was working at Morgan Stanley in New York City for Brooks Harvey, which was a real estate division. And my boss was the first one to read Bittersweet, and he named it a neo-Gothic lesbian Western. This is a very narrow genre. I think in 1983, I was the queen of this genre. So the book sold, St. Martin's Press bought it, and I thought, this is it. You know, I'm a writer. It's smooth sailing from here on. I didn't sell another book for 5 years. No, it was 10 years. I didn't sell another book for 10 years. I wrote them. And the most wonderful thing happened. Katrina hit. And all of these books that I had written were in the basement, and they were all destroyed. So now I can safely say it was some of the finest literature of the 21st century was lost in that storm. But actually, the truth was, there were good bits and bad bits, but I learned to write, like my old alma mater, Cal Poly, said, you know, learn by doing. And that's how I learned to write. So those of you who are still struggling with it and have not yet been published, you know, keep this in mind. In fact, I was whining, I remember, to my dad at about book number four or whatever that hadn't been published, that you know, I was a failure and so forth. And Dad was an old cowboy, worked for the Forest Service, building lookout towers in the Idaho Primitive, and then became a pilot and married my mom. And he was sitting there, and I was telling him how bad it was and how what a terrible failure I was. And he said, you know, honey, he said, sometimes you just got to wear the bastards down. So that's what happened. I finally wore the bastards down. And so had Bittersweet was published in my neo-Gothic lesbian Western in 1983. And it sold in total, I think, 1,200 copies, about 1,180 of which Mama bought. So then it took 10 years of trial and error before I stumbled upon Anna Pigeon. And during these 10 years, I was writing. I was writing like crazy, and I was also working at what I had been trained to be, which was an actor. I have an MFA in acting from the University of California. And I was doing okay. I mean, I did buy a house. Okay, it was only a $55,000 house, but I bought a house on what I made as an actor. But Meryl Streep was not losing sleep for fear, oh, God, if Nevada shows up to auditions, I'm in the soup now. But I did do, in these years, I did do one piece that is I think, internationally known. And close your eyes. I'm going to do it for you. You'll know it. You've all heard it. Okay, close your eyes. I'm sorry. The number you have reached is no longer in service. Did a lot of voiceovers for AT&T. So during these years, I was making a living as an actress, and I was writing as best I could, and it was in the 80s, and so I fell in love with the environmental movement because, you know, everything was just, you know, coming up green then, and there was money everywhere, and things were happening, and so I decided I wanted to do something out of doors, do something for the environment, and I'd grown up pretty much out of doors in the country. I was a country kid, and I figured, well, I could be a park ranger in the summers, and then I could still act in the winters because there's not much acting work in the summers anyway, and I could make a living. So I'd say a friend of mine, but those of you who know me would know it was just a big fat lie. My first husband, I'm now on my last best husband, thank you, got a job up at Isle Royale, and he became a park ranger. He got a master's in, I mean, if you think a master's in acting is silly. Mr. Barnes, who I adored, got a master's in leisure studies. So I went to Lassen first, and then he was going to go to Isle Royale, and I really, really wanted to be a park ranger. And he was an interpreter. And I thought, well, I don't want to be an interpreter. That's like underpaid acting. I mean, that's just silly. And besides, you have to know so much stuff when you're an interpreter. I don't know why. What do I want to do? So I was in a dentist's office, and you know how dentists in America, the American Dental Association, orders their magazines from the Smithsonian's archive section, you know? So there was these ancient magazines there, and I pulled one out, and it had a story about park rangers, law enforcement park rangers, and they had gone into a bear's cave in the winter. So I don't know if it was Voyager or Glacier, but the bear was hibernating, and they went in with the researcher, and they brought out the little tiny baby bears that were born in the winter. And they were tagging the little bears, and they were measuring the little bears and weighing the little bears, and then they put them back with their mama. And I thought, I want to be a law enforcement ranger. I love baby bears. So I signed up, and I got into a seasonal law enforcement training school in Santa Rosa, California. There was, at that time, two seasonal law enforcement training schools in the country, and I went to Santa Rosa. And I got out there, and a generation where there was not a ton of female law enforcement rangers. I think there were two of us there. And the school was housed in this old, defunct Santa Rosa women's prison. So I'm shown to my room, and it's got a cast iron door with a little tiny window in it, with wire in it. And I walk into my new room for the next 6 weeks, and there's my toilet. You know, wonderful. And just past the toilet is my cot and a desk. So as a sop to civilization, they had made it so you could close the little window in case you wanted to use any of your facilities within, you know, standing distance. So I got my law enforcement, seasonal law enforcement training there. And then my first park was Guadalupe Mountains National Park. And I went down there knowing next to nothing. 6 weeks of training to face these things, but of course, fortunately, they do it when you're young enough, you think you got it. You learned all that. So I went down there, and I was in the backcountry. How many of you guys have been to Guadalupe? I expect, yeah, a lot of people here from Colorado. I was in the unit that's kind of a Texas exclosure, where Texas, and then there's this 2,500-foot rise up into this old relic forest. And so I was doing a lot of backcountry work up there. And I would, you had to pack in all your water and you had to pack in all your food. So nobody went up there. It was just too arduous. So I would be up there for days on end, staying in this little backcountry shack up there. In fact, it was terrible. They decided they had to commune with the wilderness, and they would go to Guadalupe, and they would make this terrible 4-mile, 2,500-foot climb in the heat, and they'd get up there to the solitude, and here's the ranger saying, hi, who's president? Have you seen anything good on TV lately? Hi, do you want to come to dinner tonight? What are you doing? It's kind of bleak. But while I was up there, and all this time I had been writing, I'd written a number of books, and I'd actually published my neo-Gothic lesbian Western. And all this time, I took one creative writing class in college. It was taught by, his name was either David Richardson or Richard Davidson, I can't remember. And he was a very skinny little fellow. You could snap his neck like that. And I was very young, and I was writing my creative writing stuff, and I'd sign it. Nevada Bar, you know. And Richard Davidson or David Richardson said, you know, you can't sign that. You're not anybody. And if you sign it again, I'm going to give you a C for whatever you turn in. So, of course, I signed every paper and got a C for everything I turned in. And so even now, 45 years later, I sometimes, when I'm in a bad mood, cheer myself up by picturing David Richardson or Richard Davidson sitting on the curb with his beverage in a paper sack in front of a Barnes & Noble display. Revenge is wonderful. So anyway, either in Richard Davidson or David Richardson's class or someplace else, I'd heard about finding your voice as a writer. And I'm sure most of you out there who write have heard this. And I didn't really know what it meant. It was like when I was in acting, and all those years they'd say, well, you know, truth is, I wasn't a very good actor. And directors would say to me all the time, Nevada, you just lack commitment. And I think, what the heck does that mean? And then I started teaching acting, and I was a better teacher than I was an actor. And I'd look at these people, and I think, that's what it means. You lack commitment. You know, and it was the same thing with the voice. You hear it, and you don't know what it means until you do know what it means. And when I was in, thank you. It happens more and more. When I was in Guadalupe, I found my voice. I was wandering around up there in the high country, annoying the pants off the solitude seekers. And as with many, many women writers, Sue Grafton and some other women I've talked to, I became a mystery writer for the classic reason there was somebody who needed to die. And you know, there's a list. And I was spending a lot of time thinking about how I could do this and get away with it. And I hadn't been a mystery reader up till then. I mean, of course, you know, 11 years old, one summer I read all the Nancy Drews, but it just wasn't something that I latched onto naturally. And I was into all the old dead English writers, you know, and I didn't really know anything much about series. So I just sat down and I started writing this Anna Pigeon book about somebody very close to me. I was, you know, a backcountry ranger. I was in Guadalupe Mountains National Park. I was tracking mountain lions. And suddenly it was as if all the time before that I had been trying to carve words out of granite with a spoon. And when I discovered Anna, I discovered my voice. And it became everything is hard about it except Anna's voice. The plotting is hard, the characters are hard, but Anna's voice just flows. And over the years, we started out very, very close. Of course, she was prettier than me, smarter than me, taller than me, and a better ranger than me, but it was my book, so there. And over the years, we've slowly grown in different directions, but still, I love the challenge of writing new characters, and there's a challenge of taking a series character along, but whenever I get back into Anna Pigeon's voice, it's like, you know, when you finally take off, you know, all that binding clothing, and you slide into your jammies, and it's just, ah, oh, now we can talk. So I've had a wonderful run with Anna. She, as you know, has been in many parks. In fact, I was the superintendent, whose name I won't mention, but she's right there, told me that I just had to stop writing two books in one park because, what did you say, there were 390 parks and monuments?
397.
397. I didn't know there were that many. I thought there were 360 or something. 397 parks and monuments and national seashores and so forth. And so I do have job security. That's the good thing. But the bad thing, as she was pointing out, is that time does pass and I can't be diddling around doing two stories in one park. I have a lot of country to cover. So I've been covering as much as I could. And my editor, when I was with Putnam, wonderful woman named Chris Pepe, and I don't let Anna stagnate because, you know, like Woody Allen's shark, you don't keep moving, you die. So Anna has to get older with me because I'm interested in what I'm interested in, you know, not what I was interested in when I was 38. And my editor said, you know, she said, couldn't Anna like age in reverse dog years, you know? For every 7 years you get older, she could just, you know, 1 year. But I've been dragging her forth. And we've had a wonderful time. The stories have been getting harder, as you may have noticed. Winter Study was a hard book. And Burn was a very hard book. And it's not because I'm getting more cynical. I think it is because as you grow older, although you adore and admire the innocence of youth and the beliefs that you could have, sometimes you just can't have those anymore. You know the politicians aren't the creme de la creme that were picked from the best of the best. You know they just sort of showed up and decided to run, and that's your choice. So for this book, I was going through, you know, Anna always kind of reflects what I'm going through, and this is I stepped away from having her age in this book because I was going through this very, well, it was my second bad divorce. I tell you, the first one, when people say they had an amicable divorce, I think they weren't really married. Come on, you know. And the first one was when I wrote my second book. I ran home to Mama, of course, because I didn't have a job. I didn't have anything. The first Anna Pigeon book was out, and she was redoing Grandmother's A-frame. Grandma was dead, because she knew I was so depressed, and she wanted to be cheerful and light and joyous. So she hired the Jones boys, who are fabulous carpenters, to come in and knock skylights in the roof and knock half of the living room out so you'd have a loft bedroom. And this was my first realization that when construction people say it'll be done in 6 weeks, they don't mean in a row. So Johnny Joins knocked all the holes in the ceiling, knocked all the walls out, and then had something else to do. And winter came on. It was the worst winter since the winter I was born. We had 8 feet of snow. The deer were starving to death, and I trekked through, you know, like this huge drifts of snow to Mama's every night to sit in her hot tub and trek back. And that was when I started the second Anna Pigeon book, because the first one had sold. And I thought, you know, I better just start on something or I'll die. And so I was sitting there in this snow, and I was writing Superior Death. And I had visions of Jack Nicholson, you know, in The Shining. You know, I'm sitting there in this huge snowdrift typing, you know, all work and no play makes Nevada a dull girl. So when I finally got a job offer from Mississippi, it was a full-time job offer with medical, dental, and a place to live, and I just jumped at it. I was pretty desperate, but I knew I was weighing on Mom's nerves, and I'd never been to Mississippi. In fact, nobody I knew had ever been to Mississippi. My sister, who was a pilot then for U.S. Air, said, "We don't even land in Mississippi." So I packed everything up, and I drove out to Mississippi, and I just pretty much drove straight through, and I got there at the creek of dawn on an April morning, and my first shock was it was in color. My whole vision of Mississippi was from those grainy, Civil Rights March stuff on those old televisions. So I get there, it's in color, and it is gorgeous. I mean, flowers are coming up. The trace looks like it's decorated for a wedding. So I'm just stunned. But I'm the first woman they've ever hired on the southern end of the Natchez Trace. And they hired me because I was 38 or so, and I was kind of known to have a bit of an edge, and they thought I'd survive better, you know, as the first woman thrown down there. So the guys weren't all that thrilled about it, these old term rangers down there. And so I got the worst shifts. I got the 6 to 2 in the morning shifts, late night shifts. And Mississippi hospitality is a very real thing. In other places, they will invite you to dinner because you're new in town. In Mississippi, they will invite you to dinner till you have a family of your own. And one of the things that they just hated, being I was the first woman they'd ever seen, you know, on the trace, this far down in at night, and they'd always say, well, aren't you afraid being out here all alone at night? I said, does your boss know you're out here all alone at night? And do you want me to follow you to your next stop since you're out here all alone at night? And so I've been hearing this, and night is not my best work time. And I guess I'd been there 3 or 4 weeks, been working this late shift, been dealing with everything new, and it was about 1 in the morning, and I pulled this powder blue Cadillac over for doing 70 and a 50 mile an hour, and I pull it over, and in the Cadillac is this gorgeous southern woman, you know, the kind you can't tell if she's 60 or 80. Everything's perfect, the hair, the face, the makeup, the Cadillac, the rings. And she's sitting there, and I'm writing her a ticket, and I'm kind of cranky, and she says, well, honey, aren't you afraid out here all by yourself at night? And I got kind of flippant, and I said, nope. I said, I carry a great big gun. And she said, honey, we all do. I just love Mississippi. I have to tell you one more Mississippi before I move on to more modern, up-to-date things. I've been there 5 or 6 weeks, and I pull this big green truck over. It's during the day. I pull him over. He's going 66 and a 50. So I pull him over, and it's a fisheries and wildlife guy. Do we have any fisheries and wildlife guys here tonight? Oh, no, just scratching his mustache. Thought I had one. Well, so I pull him over. He's a big, big black guy. And he gets out, and he starts telling me about being a fisheries and wildlife guy. And we're talking, and he says, well, you want to see what I got in the back of my truck? I said, sure. We go around the back of this truck, and it's one of those big green ones. It's got the tailgate here and the big silver toolbox that people put. In the back of his truck is an alligator. And it's not a big one. It's about 6-7 foot long alligator. And it has a leash around its neck. And he took it out of Mississippi College's girls' dorm, where it had been put by some frat boys for a lark, and he was taking it back out to set it loose in the bayou. And I'd never seen an alligator except on PBS specials. And when they're young like that, I guess 6 foot's about 6 years old, they, you know, when they're old, they look like big old muddy logs. But when they're young, they're beautiful with yellows and greens and the little ridges and the little tails and stuff. And I'd only seen them on PBS, and I thought, well, I've heard of alligator boots, alligator belts. So I just wanted to touch him, so I reached down and I grabbed his tail. They're so fast. They are so fast. You cannot believe it. And this alligator whips around his head out from under that toolbox. But they're not as fast as the black guy who doesn't want to be known as the guy who fed the first white female ranger to an alligator. So George grabs me, you know, and he sets me down over there. So my first Christmas card as a full-time park ranger was I was standing with my alligator on the leash, and George took a picture of us, and I made that my Christmas card and sent it out. So I worked as a full-time permanent on the trace for a couple of years, and then the books started taking off. They started really going, and I was spending more and more time writing and promoting, and I knew it was time to go when I pulled a guy over and I wrote him a ticket, and he said, ooh, Nevada Bart, can I keep this or do I have to send it in with a check? And I thought, okay, time to move on. So I worked as a seasonal a little bit longer than that. But since then, I've had to, instead of being able to do my research on your tax dollars, which I did adore, I've had to go out and actually do research. And for this newest one, as Anna, you know, tends to channel my emotions, I was going to set this one in Acadia, and I'd been out there and spent time with the chief ranger and had a wonderful time. And then I was going through emotionally a very difficult time, a legal issue where, I don't know if you men will understand this, but the women will. Once the legal lawyers and stuff get hold of you, it doesn't matter if you're superintendent of a park, if you're president of a corporation, if you've been supporting yourself for 60 years. You're just a dumb little woman. And they talk over your head, and they talk around you, and they, you know, and I was just getting the feeling that I like least in the universe. It's even below nausea, way below nausea. Helplessness. I felt helpless. I felt like I could not stand up. I could not defend myself. I was just a little leaf in the rapids of the moment. And, of course, if I'm suffering, I think suffering in silence and suffering alone is highly overrated. So Anna had to go through what I was going through. So I'm kind of forming the plot, and I'm thinking about it. Of course, I talked to my sister, Molly, all the time. And finally she said, you know, you're getting tighter and tighter. Why don't you just put Anna in a coffin and nail the lid shut, you know? So I was getting down, and I realized for the helplessness that I really wanted to explore, because this was a sensation that I was fighting against, and I may tell you, triumphed most magnificently. But while I was fighting through this, Anna was doing it because she is kind of my alter ego. And so to make her absolutely as helpless as I wanted, she couldn't be Anna Pigeon. She couldn't be the consummate professional. Because other than breaking every bone in her body, you know, she would still have mental reserves. So I took her back to before she was Anna Pigeon, when she had just left New York City and had not gone to the wilderness for healing or because she loved it, but simply run there to forget and to, you know, commit some sort of social suicide. And after I decided that this was what I wanted to do, I wanted to take her before she was Anna Pigeon, before she had found a way to bring strength out of the wilderness. And so I pick the park first, and I pick the crime first. But this time, I picked the emotional story first, and I started shopping for a park to put it in. And I had been past Glen Canyon, you know, driven through Page back and forth, but I'd never really visited it. And I thought, you know, this might be the perfect place because, heck, it's a bathtub. Come on, you know, they just filled it up. It's got to be super simple. So I go out there. It is the most complex park I have ever visited in my time in the Park Service. It has everything. It has the history that it has drowned. It has the history that it has created. It has what man needs and wants crashing in to what the world has left there for us. It has those that want to recreate with wild abandon, and yet it's run by the Park Service, who must preserve it for future generations. And besides all of these marvelous crashing togethers that I needed for Anna's moments of cataclysmic change, it had solution holes. How many of you guys know what a solution hole is? I had no idea till I went out to Glen Canyon. You know, it's all sandstone. There's this layer of sandstone, that layer of sandstone. They all have names, and gray, white, red, yellow. And in all this sandstone that has been laid down over the millennia, there were places in there that there was a substance that was softer, a substance that would go into solution. And so the sandstone built up these mesas and cliffs, and the soft stuff over the millennia melted away. And the best way to picture these is if you picture a pot that a potter has thrown, a beautiful pot with all the, you know, striations of color and so forth, and you bury it neck deep. And in that pot, that would be a solution hole. And there's hundreds and hundreds of them. And some of them are so tiny you could put a little frog in there and he could have a little pond to himself. And the second biggest one in the world is also in Glen Canyon. And the park pilot flew us over it. And we looked down and here's this huge underground pot. And there's sand in the bottom because, of course, sand's blown in over the many years. And there's this giant oak tree in it. It's probably not an oak tree. It's probably, I know, I'll hear on my website that says it's not an oak tree, you idiot. It's this kind of tree. But anyway, it was a big leafy green tree. And the leaves did not reach the surface of the earth. That's how big some of these are. And when I discovered these, and I was dealing with this whole thing of being absolutely helpless and overcoming it with strength and ingenuity and courage you didn't know, I grabbed Anna at 33 years old, I stripped off her clothes, I bonked her on the head, and I threw her in a solution hole. And that's the beginning of the new book. So that's where I am with the rope. It's been getting marvelous reviews, and I've been getting marvelous crowds of people to come and listen to about it. But I think it's going to be interesting. I think you're going to enjoy it. I can't say I enjoyed writing it, but I sure liked how it turned out. So that counts. I guess I better take some questions, and then we'll do some work. I'll call names. Okay.
Your last book was just so dark. That was one about exploited children.
Oh, Burn.
I just wondered if there was something in your environment or something in your personal life that led you to that.
You
have a good sense of humor, so.
She was asking if Byrne was a very dark book in the sense of the abuse of children, if there was something in my personal life that had fomented this. I did not intend for it to be that dark. I had I didn't tour for Byrne because I was burned out. No pun intended, but I researched Byrne, and it said in the sexual industry in New Orleans, and I researched this industry. My girlfriend, she's my age. She comes down from Mississippi, and we decide, okay, I'm not going to go to the strip clubs alone. You know, that's ridiculous. This could be dangerous. So Linda and I go, women of a certain age. We don't like to stay up too late, you know, because we get up early. So we have dinner appointments at 8 o'clock. So we go into all of these strip clubs. We walk in and we sit down, and there's nobody there. And the girls talk to us, and they tell us about everything. And so I thought, well, this isn't very interesting. You know, they've all got the same story. So I started getting up and going to the ladies' room. And in the seedier joints in the ladies' room was where the girls smoked dope, drank beer, got made up for the next act. So I did get some good information there. But Linda goes home. She's telling her son. She said, you know, these strip clubs, they're really quite tame. And he said, Mom, you should be there after midnight. Not that I've ever been. But then we decided, okay, I've got to go to it's a club that you can buy a membership for $70. And it was called the Coquette or something. And it's a private sex club. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go do this. I couldn't ask Linda to go. I mean, she's a Mississippi Episcopalian. I couldn't do it. So I'm staying at her apartment. So I go down there by myself, and I pay my $70, and I go in. I am dressed like in a turtleneck and a full-length skirt and long sleeves. And I decided to go Elizabethan, you know. So I go in there, and I go up the elevator. Wonderful people. They're so nice. And actually, it's very controlled. In the elevator ride up, this lovely young man, after complimenting me and flirting with me politely, you know, and thinking, she looks so like Grandmama, you know. telling me, no means no, you know, don't touch unless you ask. So I get up there, and I'm sort of there, and it opens up into this, like Sherlock Holmes's library, very dark, and there's leather couches sitting around, and there's a couple doing what people might do in a sex club on one end of the couch, and then there's a woman in full S&M gear and a couple guys drinking, and then catty corner from the woman in full S&M gear is a lady in a bra and panties and the garter belt things, who should have had a little more coverage, in my opinion. But so I'm eavesdropping, and I'm slinking around in my Elizabethan, listening to things, and the dominatrix is saying to the woman in the negligee outfit, you know, so I drop Pam off at soccer, and you know, and I'm thinking, you know, no matter where you go, there you are. You know? So my research into that book was rather lighthearted, accidentally, but then I started doing research on, I had the child sex slavery thing in the back of my mind, and I thought it was bogus, and I was just going to do this little bitty thing. It was just going to be like a little subplot, kind of blown off. And so I started researching it. And if you've been following the news since, it's huge, and it's huge in America. And once I started digging into it and realizing that I thought it was just like a few perverts. You know, it was not a big thing, but it was a huge industry. And once I stumbled on it, it was like when I stumbled on the fact that mud was, you know, in the Dry Tortugas at Fort Jefferson, you can't just turn your back on it and walk off. The book has to take it up. And so I watered it down as much as I could so the reader would get the idea without just being depressed and horrified. So that's how I came upon that. It was through the internet. In fact, I think when Big Brother finally asserts himself, every author in America will be immediately arrested for, you know, researching children who kill children, how to blow up the World Trade Towers, you know. So that's all the things we're doing. So that's how the darkness came there.
I love the Anna Pigeon books, but
oh, there's a but. There's a but. Oh, my God. It's like when somebody says, you know, I loved your book, however. You hear however, but you run for the door. Okay, you love the Anna Pigeon books, but
one of my favorites is Seeking Enlightenment.
Ah, this is the woman with the watch. Obviously a woman of great taste. Seeking Enlightenment.
Could you just talk about where you were at that point? I don't remember the copyright, but I have two copies, and I've used it for programs and women retreats and all kinds of
things. She is talking about Seeking Enlightenment, which is a book I wrote, and it's just a collection of things that had been on my mind for years, and I'd write down a little thing. They're just little short pieces, and I kind of put them all together, you know, and I had this marvelous title that I had, and I thought, well, I'll just send it to my agent, and I sent it to my agent, and he sold it. And then there was this horrible moment of, oh, no, don't sell that. That stuff's true. You know? So it was, and of course, if I wrote it again today, it would be very different. But it was just things that mattered to me that I thought about. And I was an Episcopalian for 10 years. I've never been, my parents were not Christians. They were kind of pantheist atheists. And I was raised atheist. I've never been a Christian, but I was a really good Episcopalian for 10 years. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I'd found a way to have some kind of faith in something. It was heaven. I lost it. But during the period that I had found it, I wrote that book. And it was a very interesting time of my life. And so that is just reflections. And it was then used in many Episcopal churches for preaching and so forth. And my mother said, you know, if they mentioned your name from the pulpit, I never thought it'd be in this way. Well, as they say in AA, does anybody have a burning desire before we go to sign books? One last thing you have to say or ask? Ooh, what would be one of my favorite authors these days? This is probably not at all the answer you want, but I have just been going nuts for Jance. It's the Jackie Faber Bloody Jack series.
Oh, yeah.
What's the author's name? Lewis Meyer. Lewis Meyer. L.A. Meyer. And they are fabulous. They're about they're set 1800s, and it's about a little young girl in, you know, street urchin in London who dresses as a boy and becomes a ship's boy. And there's a whole series of them. And I got turned on to them because I was doing, my husband is a fabulous carpenter and has redone both bathrooms with exquisite tile. But I am the grout queen. And I don't let him touch the grout. The grout is important. And so when I was doing all this grouting, I needed books on CD so I could listen to something. And I checked out the Lewis Meyer Bloody Jack series, and I'm totally hooked. I'm totally hooked. This is what all of us out there were craving when we were little girls. We didn't want Ned and the tame little things. We wanted serious adventure. So that's what I've been reading. Well, thank you so much. I have enjoyed it very much, as always, and we'll get to work. Thank you. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.